Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This is Kevin Conroy, the voice of Batman. And you're listening to the DCAU Review, hosted by Cal and Liam, streaming at DCAUReview.com and on your favorite podcast app.
In the year 2039, Gotham City has no heroes. Its people, no hope. Its youth, no future.
Evening, boys and girls. Who's up for some laughs?
Terry McGinnis was part of the problem.
You can't control your temper, and you'd better if you expect to get anywhere in life.
Yeah, I'll be a big success, just like you.
Until a moment of violence brought him to the door of a man named Bruce Wayne.
Let's put a smile on his face.
Leave him alone. Once known as the Batman.
Man, you're something. Are you okay?
Now, the Dark Knight will rise again to drive the shadow of evil from the streets of Gotham. Let's go! Supervillains, beware! There's a new Batman in town. Batman Beyond.
You're pretty strong for some clown who thinks he's Batman.
I am Batman.
Justice returns to Gotham. Welcome to my world.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 144 of the DCAU Review. I am one of your hosts, Cal, and with me is my good brother, good friend, and the gentleman that runs our Twitter page. That's right, it's Liam. Liam, we're in a brand new month, second month of the year here. We made it through 1 month of this new year, and that means we are starting off with a new show. And we decided to go back to the future.
The future, Cal?
That's right. All the way to the year, whatever,
50 years from now,
whenever now is. Right, exactly.
That's right. We are, in fact, talking about the Tomorrow Knight, the Batman of the future, Batman Beyond. It has been a while since we have gone to the futuristic Gotham City, but we are back this week with the episode Final Cut.
Yeah, we're picking up right where we left off. We do all of our Batman episodes in order of production, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So we are continuing here with that trend. And this episode, Liam, is a follow-up to the original Curare episode, A Touch of Curare. So we get one of the original Batman Beyond rogues created for this series. Well, most of them were, but a Batman Beyond original follow-up to her story, and picking up right where we left off with her. We'll get into that in just a little bit here when we discuss our plot for this week's episode. But before we do, as we always seem to do here, we are going to start this episode off with our IMDb official synopsis for this episode, which originally debuted, get this, Liam, February 5th, 2000. That's right. If you're listening to this episode on the day that it premieres, that is February 6th, 2021, which means we just celebrated yesterday the 21-year anniversary of this episode.
Wow, and I'd like to say that we did that on purpose, but it's just another one of those happy accidents.
Hey, we could have taken it. We could have taken credit for it and pretended.
Well, hey,
like
you
we
edit
did.
These things, man. I'll find out if we leave this in or not on the day the episode airs.
Good point.
But anyway, never mind. This episode is live, of course.
That's right. So,
anyway, this is for the episode Final Cut, which was written by Hilary J. Bader and Alan Burnett. Directed by Butch Lukic, with music by Christopher Carter, and animation by Coco. And that synopsis reads as such. Batman is blackmailed by a bomb threat to protect a member of the Society of Assassins from Curare.
All right, that's simple, sweet, and to the point. Not a bad synopsis, if I do say so. So let's jump into our plot discussion here, Liam. So as we mentioned, this is a follow-up to the episode A Touch of Curare, which I believe was Batman Beyond Season 1.
Correct.
So we learned in that that there was this assassin that was hired to kill Batman, and she comes in and...
To kill Commissioner Gordon.
I'm sorry, you're right.
Husband, actually.
You're right. Batman just got in the way and became like an associated target. But,
that's right.
Yeah, unfortunately, she, or fortunately, depending on... Unfortunately for her, she failed in her attempt to kill Commissioner Gordon's husband, and thus she became the hunted. As we find out, she escapes at the end of the episode, but sort of leaves on a cliffhanger. She's driving this vehicle away, and there's a sword that pops through the roof and cut to black. So this episode picks up, and we are at an airport someplace with a guy who looks a little bit like a Bond villain or a Dr. Mindbender from G.I. Joe type.
He's
got a fancy monocle. He was, I believe, shown in the first Curare episode, more of like a shadowy figure, though, nondescript. And he shows up back here in this episode. So we find out he's one of the leaders of the League of Assassins, and turns out that Curare has been picking off these leaders one by one. We learn that it's sort of alluded to that she's killed them, but we maybe find out later on that maybe she hasn't actually killed them.
What?
I'm in Gotham.
Have you located a target?
Not yet. It's not easy when you're always looking over your shoulder.
You're letting your fear make you too cautious.
Me? You're the one
who spent the last 3 months in the air, afraid to land anywhere because she might find you.
She already got to Karima.
No.
In Lisbon, 3 days ago. We're the only two left. Hold on.
Devon? Devon, what is it? What's going on?
It's her.
Curare.
Yeah, so, we get this, and we'll certainly talk a lot more, I think, about the Curare stuff in visuals, because she's a character that doesn't talk a lot, so most of the scenes involving her are very action-heavy, but, yeah, she's throwing these, like, she brings this big, sharp sword that can cut through anything, but then when the chips are down, she just throws this capsule of green gas. It explodes on two different guys' chests in this episode, and it makes their eyes roll into the back of their head, and then we later on get a don't worry, kids, they're not dead line from a paramedic checking on the second assassin, who, it's not that he's dead, his mind is just wiped, which you pointed out, Cal, is actually, there's precedent for this in the DCAU review, as folks would know if they went back and listened to our review of Off Balance with that episode's director, Kevin Altieri.
That's right. We mentioned, and he mentioned, that they, of course, you know, standards and practices would not allow them, of course, to kill people, at least on screen. So instead, they had the horrifying visual instead of in that opening scene of that episode. Kevin mentioned that they had the idea of these sort of like capsules that they had stored in their mouths, which is a familiar trope and used in various different forms of media and movies as a way for them to sort of hail Hydra themselves on the way out. So they wipe their minds by activating these capsules that release this gas from underneath their masks, and their eyes seem to roll into the back of their heads as well. So yeah, following up with that, apparently she's weaponized these capsules and is able to sort of just hurl them at people, and able to do it not by hitting them in the face, but by just hitting them right in the sternum.
Yeah, so she wipes out the monocled assassin leader, who I don't believe gets a name.
Nondescript assassin leader.
That's right. Looks a little like Blofeld from James Bond, as you mentioned. But yeah, so from there that assassin leader was talking to Mutro Bothra. We find out this nondescript accented man, which we will get to in voice acting certainly later on. Who is now, once the assassin leader is taken care of, he is the sole remaining member of the Society of Assassins, and he knows that Curare is coming for him, so he does what anyone would do. He goes to Gotham to track down the only person to ever defeat Curare, that of course being Batman, but he knows that Batman isn't likely to just help him out of the goodness of his heart, considering that he is also a murderer and a killer, and Terry kind of has that attitude of those two deserve each other and whatever. So he also plants a bomb in Gotham City with the promise that if he does not give it some sort of verbal command every 12 hours, that the bomb will go off. So
this is all your fault.
What is?
When you prevented Curare from killing her target, the punishment for her failure was death. Unfortunately, we underestimated her. She fought back. One by one, she hunted us down. I am the only one left. And you are the only one who can keep me that way.
And why should I care to?
Because when she has finished with me, she will come after you.
Thanks for the warning. I'll be sure to look for your name in the obits.
I thought you might feel that way, so I took the liberty of providing a little incentive. I planted a bomb in your city, a rather large one, set to go off unless it receives a properly guided signal from me every 12 hours. Go ahead. Take it. It won't do you any good. Only I know the codes. I'm not an unreasonable man. You help me defeat Curare, and I'll disarm the bomb. If not, if Curare gets to me first, boom! Gotham experiences a sudden population decline.
He sort of forces Terry to act as his bodyguard, and the only other really wrinkle beyond there before we get to the fighting and punching towards the end of the episode is that Bruce Wayne is out of town. They mentioned he's in Malaysia and he's unavailable. He can't be reached as there was some sort of natural disaster in the area recently. And so we have Max taking a more active role as the backup for Terry. Terry tries to just get her to try to contact Bruce, but instead she takes it on herself to search this assassin's hotel room to try to look for clues as where this bomb could be, and has a run-in with Curare herself, which she's only not dead because Curare didn't want her dead,
right?
As we find out.
Yeah.
Speak.
Max, it's me. Any luck with Bruce?
The SATCOM's down for at least another hour. I got the computer running an automated search just in case.
Why? Aren't you at home? Max, what's going on?
Let's just say I'm doing a little search myself.
Tell me you didn't go to his hotel room. This isn't a game, Max. I want you out of there, now!
Hey, your suit doesn't give you barking rights over me, McGinnis. Besides, as long as you got your eye on him, I don't see the danger.
Max!
Oh, what's happening? Ah!
Mutro, Curare's at the hotel. My friend's there.
And then your friend is already gone.
I have to go back.
Fool.
She, it's an interesting scene because it certainly there's a lot of tension in it. There's stuff visually that we'll talk about in a second that lead you to believe that maybe Max has been killed a couple of times.
Yes.
In that scene. But of course, we learn as Terry sort of leaves his guarding position, temporary bodyguard position to go find Max. He arrives at the hotel room and Max is sort of huddled in the shower and very traumatized, obviously, mm-hmm. for good reason. And Terry makes sure to remind her in this moment because as they were over the comms and Curare was attacking her, she screamed out, "Terry!" So after Terry sort of calms her, sort of gives her the, you know, head home and, you know, stop playing superhero pep talk, he reminds her also not to call him Terry, which I thought was very Batman.
Yeah, that was a very cool moment.
Max! Max!
Oh, Terry.
Oh. Are you all right?
Yeah. As soon as she got a good look at me, she backed off. Aren't you gonna yell at me?
I figured you already got the message. I gotta get back. You go home and stay there. And one more thing.
Yeah?
Don't call me Terry.
And, yeah, from there, as we mentioned, Kiara does in fact make it to Boutreaux and mind wipes him as well. And, from there, the only person left for her to go after is, of course, Batman himself. And so while Terry and Max are able to sort of get an idea of where this bomb that can no longer be disabled because the man's mind has been wiped, they track it to this museum of armaments mm-hmm. and weaponry, I guess.
Yeah.
Throughout history, we see things like catapults. Again, we'll get more into this in visuals, but everything from tanks and catapults to models of the atomic bomb are on display in this museum. So while they're trying to search for the bomb, of course, Kiara attacks, so you have this sort of race against time as Max is searching through the museum. Meanwhile, Terry is taking on probably his most physically, you know, at least hand-to-hand-wise or straight-up combat-wise, the most dangerous foe he's ever fought, at least to this point in the series.
For sure.
So that's kind of a fun element. And then finally, in the battle, as Batman and Kiara are fighting up in the rafters, this model of the atomic bomb crashes down, and wouldn't you know it, he hid his big, giant chemical bomb in the atomic bomb display.
How do you think he got it down off the ceiling and re-raised it?
Yeah, did he, like, disguise himself as, like, a construction worker? He was, like, in a scaffolding or, like, a scissor lift? So very intricate to get it all the way up top there, but he managed to do it. And, of course, the classic way, when you don't really have a way for anyone to disarm a bomb, Max just unplugs the timer and
she just breaks things.
Yeah. And hey, it worked.
Yeah, what do you know?
And at the same time, Terry's able to disable Kiara and put the cuffs on her. And we sort of end with just sort of this brief little heart-to-heart of Max kind of asking Terry, how does he do this all the time? And more importantly, how do you do this and not want to just tell everybody about it? And Terry tells her that's one of the reasons he's so glad she found out his secret, is that now he does have someone his own age to talk to about these incredible adventures he's gone on. So,
how do you do it?
Do what?
This hero thing.
It's easier for me. I got the suit.
No. How do you save the world and not tell anybody?
I can tell you. You can tell me. That's why I'm glad you found out, partner.
It's, as we start to get towards our scores here for plot, it's not, the deepest episode.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's fun, it moves well, and you get some nice little, like, friendship building for Terry and Max.
Yeah, the episode, Bruce is, if you mentioned it at the beginning of the episode, Bruce is mentioned to be in Malaysia, I think.
Yes, I believe they say so.
So he's off, and he's not able to be in contact with Terry due to some natural disaster that's happened there. They're not able to really, Max tries to get in touch with him, but is still not able to do so. So Max sort of becomes the stand-in for Bruce as mm-hmm. Terry's support eyes on the ground. And while she creates her own sort of troubles for Terry
yes.
and for Batman and stress where Bruce may not have done so. He ends up at the end of this episode during this little pep talk and speech where Max is questioning how he doesn't just go around telling everybody that he's Batman. He calls her partner. He mm-hmm. tells, you know, which is a very telling sign and certainly an advancement of this character and how this relationship is going to look going forward. So knowing that they were looking to to make this less about Bruce as often as possible and make it more of a Terry-focused series, giving them the option to have episodes where Bruce maybe wasn't the focal point or wasn't even an ancillary character, and have somebody else stand in and still have him be that, or have him have a Oracle-type character mm-hmm. as support, I think does move the... Or, like, the characters are certainly different, as we always talk about. You know, are the characters in a different place than when this episode started? And certainly the partnership between Max and Terry certainly advances after this episode.
Yeah, so like I said, I don't love this episode, but I do think it's pretty fun, and I settled on a 7 out of 10 for my plot score.
Nice. I went just a tick lower. I went 6 out of 10. I think you're right. There's nothing wrong with this episode. I think it's sad that this is the last appearance that we get, at least in the animated series, of Curare. She may have made a comic appearance.
I believe so, yes.
After this, in the tie-in comic, but she does not make another appearance here in the animated Batman Beyond series. So this is sort of her swan song, and a character that was very interesting, and certainly... I think could have been used again, but the ending is sort of anticlimactic. Batman just kind of puts the cuffs on her after this very intense battle scene that we'll talk about in just a little bit in visuals, but it left a little bit to be desired, and it reminded me a little bit of the Blight episode, the last Blight episode that we see. It's like mm-hmm. it's sort of just, this is the end of this character. We don't see them used again. It's like, doesn't quite feel like they do a character who is such a unique and focal point of, even though this character was only used in 2 episodes, you know, a unique character that had an interesting story and is just sort of tied up in a very typical Batman sort of way. So not having additional use for this character, it feels like maybe this character was a little bit more disposable than I originally thought or remembered. Yeah. Batman Beyond having Curare be. So that's why I ended up giving it a 6 out of 10. There is some fun aspects to it. Again, I think the biggest thing is the advancement of the relationship between Max and Terry, and mm-hmm. Him having another partner in this journey to go along with him. And to certainly, like you pointed out, somebody his own age, somebody that's in his own high school, somebody that can relate to and he can share this information with and talk about, and that is in on the secret and also there to support him through it.
And is, you know, experiencing a lot of this for the first time the same way Terry is versus Bruce, who, you know, has seen it all by this point. You know, zombies, immortal witch boys, multiple alien invasions, all this stuff that he's faced over his career.
Right.
Plus he's this cantankerous old man on top of it. So it's like, Terry doesn't get to geek out.
Right.
Very much when he's talking to Bruce. So yeah, having a different character there to bounce dialogue off of and discuss this stuff with is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I agree. With that said, there's nothing offensive about it. I think that there are aspects of it that are interesting. I think the idea of Curare kind of going back and exacting revenge on this, it would have been interesting to maybe fill in some of the gaps as to what happened between the end of that first episode where we see them kind of catching up to her and like she's the hunted, and then all of a sudden she's the hunter in this or huntress in this episode.
Yeah.
Filling in some of those gaps, maybe a storyline where these people that whose mind that she wiped, maybe they weren't, it wasn't successful, or mm-hmm. you know, somebody comes back to exact revenge on her that is still part of this organization or what have you, would have been a nice maybe capper for the trilogy, but obviously we didn't get that, so
yeah.
Fantasy booking that maybe for a follow-up Batman Beyond series if HBO Max decides to partake. All right, Liam, let's move on to our next category, which will be visual and animation. So I believe Coco and who's the other animation team done for
this? Yeah, it's always sort of marked as Coco / Dong Yang, I think, because it was just a different name used for the same company.
Gotcha.
And they often worked with, or they were not the same company, but they often worked together with Coco, and I think also with TMS as well. So kind of a joint effort, as it often is, between Coco and Don Yang.
Of course. And so we're, you know, moving from the hand-drawn cell animation that we had last month with the Superman animated series. Of course, we're moving back into digital animation here, digital color palettes, stuff like that. So a little bit visually different. Anything, I guess there are a couple standout scenes and sequences that we'll get into talking about here, but what stood out for you as far as visuals?
I think the design of Curare and the sword play we get throughout the episode, I think, is very cool and very... That's a really interesting... She just has this sword that's so sharp that it can cut through anything. She cuts through, you know, the door of a plane at one point. She cuts through the cannon on a tank. All this crazy stuff she's able to do with the sword, and just how quickly she moves and everything. In the first fight between her and this assassin leader with the monocle that we mentioned, that's actually something I maybe ties into plot a little bit too, but they seem to sort of imply that each member of this society of assassins had like their own specialty, because of course Kiara has her sword and Monocle Guy has throwing star shuriken that he's very adept with. He even manages to cut her, of course no blood shown, but does slice her garments slightly.
Yeah,
so it's implied. And then Butra, that he just has like explosives, I guess, were his specialty.
Big guns.
Yes, he has a big gun that he shoots like just randomly when he thinks he might have seen something in a bush or something.
I laughed. Yeah, there's the scene after Batman leaves to go rescue Max from Curare. Curare then, of course, leaves Max and goes and finds Butro. And we see him under a bridge, and he comes out under the bridge, and there's some rustling in a bush, and he pulls out this big rocket launcher or like grenade launcher or something like that. Just fires it openly into the bush. Pretty interesting there. But I agree with you. I think the animation and the way that they visualized her, both her speed, again, the weapon, the scimitar or whatever you want to call her sword, makes her feel like a formidable threat to this, to whether it's, you know, these assassins that and their henchmen that have, you know, guns and weapons and various other weapons, or Batman himself, who has this super futuristic suit, obviously. So either way, it makes her feel, she's obviously, and she's just wearing sort of like normal like cloth garb from what we can tell, and just brandishing this sword. So it's interesting to make her into a formidable opponent for these other in this high-tech, super futuristic Neo-Gotham, where everything is, you know, is technologically advanced. She's just got a sword and like a robe, and she's still kicking butt.
Yeah, she does. She does have like a Boba Fett jetpack that she uses to escape the plane at one point. But yes. Yeah, to your point, I think that is something, because even in that final battle with Terry in the museum, he is on the defensive almost the entire time. He's just avoiding being cut in half.
Right.
He looks kind of constantly overmatched, where even to this point in the series, he's, you know, quite a capable fighter in his own right, and obviously he's trained with Bruce, and as you mentioned, he has this, you know, this incredible suit with all this technology, and he's still just kind of barely... he's kind of playing keep away for a lot of that final fight, which I think makes for a really interesting dynamic where Batman is not charging head on into it, and he isn't a match for her hand to hand, so he has to be smarter about it. He has to try to get some distance and use the batarangs and use some of his gadgets to try to even the odds a bit, and she's just coming after him with such fury. I think that final scene in the museum really stands out as far as just capturing the sort of fluidity and ferocity of Curare and kind of the intelligence of Terry to kind of try to keep his distance throughout that whole fight and kind of use the gadgets to try to even the odds.
Yeah, he certainly uses the things that are available at his disposal, also using different elements of the museum and bombs and, like you said, other tanks and weapons.
A working plasma pack or something that's on display that he throws at her, and explodes all over Kirari and Max.
Yeah, yeah. He clearly, I mean, it's very Batman, using your resources, what you have available, in order to do what you can to defeat him there. We do get, more Max, in this episode than we've certainly had her in previous episodes. She gets to show off her avoidance skills from avoid being killed by an assassin. I mentioned before, I don't think, when we were going through the plot, but they do confirm that Max knows that Bruce Wayne is the mysterious guy now, by the way.
How much time do we have?
Kirare's last sighting puts her at least 3 hours away. I'm going to meet Mutro outside his hotel in about half an hour.
What's the plan?
He's the bait. When she shows, I'll get in between them. This bomb business could get bad. I'm gonna need your help, Max.
You know you can count on me, Tear. What do you want me to do?
You gotta find a way to contact my partner.
Oh.
You know, I never really told you his name.
Wait. Let me guess. Just a shot in the dark here. Could it be Bruce Wayne?
I guess it wasn't very hard to figure out.
Like, the first day.
But as she's sort of filling in for Bruce in this episode and being a help or slash hindrance to Terry as she goes out on her own and does her own sort of investigation, we mentioned that she's in Butra's hotel room, and then Kirare breaks in thinking that Butra is going to be there, and at least a couple of times appears to kill to kill Max. There's a interesting thing that they do with their silhouettes where you see Kirare's silhouette go up with a sword, and Max is on the ground, and the sword drives down into what looks like Max, but then it's a quick cut to the very next scene, which is shows that the sword went into an ottoman instead, which I thought was a neat trick.
Yeah.
I feel like maybe if they'd hung on it a little bit longer, and I imagine standards and practices probably wouldn't let them do that.
Yes.
But if you hung on it a little bit longer, that would have built up that tension a little bit of like, oh my gosh, Max is dead. Like, they just showed her kill Max.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some trickery in the next part also. As we mentioned, she's on Max is on the comm link with Terry at the time and trying to get him to come save her, and she's hiding in the shower, and you just hear Max, this blood-curling scream as Kirare slices through this shower curtain. And that visually I thought was very horror movie-esque, good, like, you know, Psycho, or like, you know, good nods to those classic, oh, you know, the teenager is hiding someplace, and the killer, you know, they're hiding in the worst, most obvious place ever, and the killer comes slicing through with their knife very dramatically through the through the shower curtain. But I thought that those were neat visuals. But I think, to me, the absolute standout comes from that final scene with Terry versus Kirare. There's one particular sequence that I think really blew both of us away.
Yeah, for sure. And so, as we mentioned, there's sort of all these different displays and up above and kind of the
By the way, the display, Batman fighting a villain in a museum, is such that's a Batman trope from any and every generation.
That's a great point.
Like,
yes.
You could definitely see that in Batman 66 or some of the Dick Sprang 50s comics. You could see it in a comic nowadays. You could see it in the original animated series.
For sure.
It's just a classic Batman trope where there's going to be a battle and it's with a villain, so why not put it in the setting of a museum?
Yeah, no, it's a great one. It's a very unique setting because you can do a lot of fun stuff with what's on display. As you mentioned, there's this plasma weapon on display, like we mentioned, and he throws it and Kirare slices through it and all this goo goes everywhere. And then, as we mentioned, they go up into the rafters where all of these models of different, you know, World War One and Two fighter planes and kind of newer, more modern looking jets and missiles and bombs and all this stuff. And Terry sort of flies up into it and pulls out batarangs and starts ringing down, and then he starts shooting out like the, I guess those are also batarangs, the little wrist gauntlet
the
ones.
Discs, like,
yeah,
the discs.
Like, yeah, it's like the little discs with like teeth on the edges. Those aren't the full batarangs, but the ones he can kind of shoot at, kind of rapid fire out of his ring. He's just raining these down on her. And as they do that, they cut to this shot of Kirare, like, jumping on to all these different eras of fighter planes and missiles and weapons, just jumping, avoiding the batarangs, and then jumping onto the next one. And it looked, Cal, like they actually used a little bit of CGI with that shot.
Right.
But they did a very good job of sort of cell shading on top of that CGI, so it doesn't look quite as noticeable as, you know, a few other times we've talked about CGI in these cartoons. It can look a little wonky or out of place if it's not done quite right. And this one, it actually works really well to see, and really adds, as we mentioned, to that, really getting across just how incredible of like an athlete, and how fast and ferocious Kirari is as she's jumping up and slicing through the ropes that are holding up these different weapons, and all the planes and missiles begin falling down, as you mentioned, and Max is kind of dodging the debris as it's falling. Like, it's a really incredible sequence.
Yeah, the way that the camera placement was too, you know, you could have just done, you know, maybe a side panoramic shot, or I mean a side scrolling type shot of her running up these different planes, but the fact that the perspective is sort of she's running towards the camera, and the camera shot is sort of panning backwards as she jumps from different, you know, plane to plane. Mm-hmm. Just a really great shot. And, you know, I think you pointed out right away, hey, I think that was CGI, which obviously I've been a huge critic of the use of the CGI, sure. Especially, you know, if you go back in the archives at DCAUreview.com and you check out some of maybe, you know, Starcrossed or some of the other JL or JLU episodes where they started incorporating the CGI that wasn't cel shaded. It's more of the traditional CGI for that era. It stands out. It looks really, really bad. This, they did do that cel shading, and if you're familiar, you know, if you watch The Simpsons or Family Guy or any of, you know, modern cartoons, this is, or Futurama even, this is a practice that they incorporate in those, where they have something that's difficult or they want to use a certain pan shot or something, and in order to most effectively do that, or I guess it's probably easier for the animators, instead of having to draw these things individually, having a computer generated image, but then so that it still fits within the universe that you're watching, they sort of create these thicker, bolder lines over top of it, which makes it not stand out as much. You can still usually identify it as, okay, that was CGI. Mm-hmm. But I think what made this most effective is, too, that it was a very quick shot, too.
Yes.
It was maybe 5 to 7 seconds long, maybe. So it's a very quick shot. Your brain almost doesn't have time to catch up with the fact that, oh, this is not normal animation here. This stands out in a way that's, okay, this is unsettling. Like, your brain doesn't have time to almost catch up with that. You know, we watched it a few different times just because it was so impressive, and that's when your brain starts to, okay, there are some things here that don't fit with the normal animation style that you can kind of pull quicker. But if you're just watching it through, it stands out as such an impressive shot. And again, it certainly adds depth to that character of Kirari, and brings out that idea that she's fast, she's threatening, she's coming for Batman here.
For sure. And even just like, because I think if they were all just painted into the background and she was hopping from one to one, it would still be a cool shot based on how it was framed and everything, but having that, having them be CGI so that they can kind of wobble and shake as she's jumping to them, I think added to that feeling of how acrobatic she is, how fluidly she moves, and how quickly she's moving up these things towards Batman. As you said, we're kind of almost have a Batman type POV shot looking down on her jumping up. It was really, really excellent job with that. And yeah, for that scene, like I said, a lot of the episode I was kind of like, well, this is just all right.
Mm-hmm.
And then that final scene, I think, pushed my score way up, and I ended up with a 9 out of 10 for visuals.
Nice. Yeah, I went with the same exact score for that. I went at 9 out of 10. There was one little hiccup that I noticed. The first scene with Bootra and Batman. Batman shows up in a, you know, Bootra gets his attention by shooting a rocket at him, or shooting a gun at him. So Batman pulls down in the Batmobile, and they have this discussion on a roof, and there's a cut that happens, and they cut back to Batman, and it's a little bit further, you know, far away shot, and Batman's standing next to the Batmobile, and there's some perspective issues where the Batmobile is suddenly much smaller than it should be.
Yes.
Like, Batman is like, bigger or as big as the Batmobile itself. And I know there's a line later on where Terry mentions that the Batmobile wasn't built for two people.
Yes.
But in most shots, you can tell the Batmobile is certainly larger, a right. lot larger than a single human being.
The cockpit is small, but yeah, the vehicle itself never looks
tiny,
human sized,
right,
or
exactly.
man sized. Certainly, like it's yeah. There was definitely a little bit of perspective issues there. You pointed that out, and it was pretty hard to unsee.
That's right.
After that.
But it's a strong one visually otherwise.
For sure.
A fun character. And again, lends to, man, I wish we had more Curare story to go on after this, because she is such a visually interesting character. Not only just the way that she looks, with the blue skin color and the white robes and the white mask and all of that, but then, you know, the way that she moves, the weapon, the visualization of her strength and her skills and all of that. So, and the way that Terry is forced to sort of combat those. So, sad that there's not more Curare.
Yeah, that's definitely a bummer. Cause she's a really fun visual character to talk about.
For sure. All right, Liam, let's move on to our next category for today, which is going to be music. So Batman Beyond has released one soundtrack on CD or whatever. They've released one soundtrack. It sort of encompassed several of the first maybe five or seven episodes of season one. Unfortunately, that is all of this soundtrack that they've released so far. So these tracks are not able to be listened to in isolation, so you're kind of listening on the fly as you go. There was one musical cue that I thought was a bit of a callback. That was the only one that stood out for me. The rest of it just seemed like general filler. There's not really a strong Curare theme that sticks out. We've talked a lot about how the Batman Beyond soundtrack was designed to sort of just advance the action. It's a lot of, and because of the sound that it is heavy in drums and heavy in guitar, it can kind of blend in to the background if there isn't something unique that stands out. What did you think of the soundtrack this week?
Yeah, I don't have a ton of notes. Something that I do remember from the first Curare episode is that there was like, while there wasn't a traditional theme, it was very percussion based, that theme.
Right.
It was a lot of like conga drums and other sort of acoustic drum sounds that sort of built into the, and then as the action kicked off, then you'd bring in the rock. And we didn't really get that on display here this episode. I mean, it still takes place at night, but it doesn't quite have that sort of eerie, dark atmosphere that the first episode with Curare had.
Sure.
So we don't really, it's just the action beats are punctuated by what you would expect, you know, electric guitar, fast paced, you know, high tempo drums. And the only few like unique moments I noticed were, I think, in the alley when Terry he's in like his camouflage mode and he's following Butra down the alley, and they're sort of discussing Curare and sort of what the plan is here. There's some kind of nice little atmospheric music there where it's just sort of like a little bit of like synthesizer, it sounded like, and some of them, it's quite atmospheric and building that tension of Terry kind of being in like a lookout, and you're kind of waiting for the bad guy to strike. And then, yeah, I think the music during the final fight was solid and high tempo. But I know you mentioned you had one that you'd like to talk about, so I will throw it back over to you here.
Thanks. Yeah, the only thing that I thought that reminded me or seemed a little bit familiar, it's the scene when Terry is rushing back to the hotel room after Max has been cut off, and you hear that blood curling scream, and Terry rushes away, and he's running into and through the hotel to try and get to Max or find Max. And the music, I felt, was very similar to, had a very similar feel to the music that plays when Terry rushes it back into his dad's house at Rebirth.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, that horrifying discovery where he realizes that, what he thinks at the time is the Jokers, have killed his dad, and, some, some sad, scary, terrifying music that sort of crescendos at that point. And you get the similar crescendo to the point where Terry runs into this bathroom and pulls back the shower curtain, and Max is there alive, though, this time. Mm-hmm. So I felt like some of those notes were similar. It's certainly a similar feeling piece. It's not a one-for-one use of the same audio, but mm-hmm. Definitely a similar piece, which I felt plays into that. They're building the tension, like, oh, my goodness, has this happened again? Has Terry lost somebody else that he's right. loved? But this time, because as Batman, you know. So I thought that the beats of that stuck out as far as being similar in tone and feeling that piece from Rebirth did. So all that, nothing offensive, as I always say, about the music here, but nothing really stuck out too much. That one piece, I think, maybe brought up the score just a little bit for me. So I ended up giving music a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm right in that same ballpark, a little bit lower there at 5 out of 10. Yeah, I like the music. Like I said, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but you don't have that standout sort of atmosphere building music that I think was present in the first QRA episode.
All right. Well, let's move on to our voice actors, Liam. Not a huge cast this week. Obviously, when one of your villains, although we do find out that she had somebody cast as maybe her grunting, and you have an interesting theory as to why that was the case. We'll get to that in just a second here. But when your main antagonist is a mute, you don't really have to have a large voice cast here, but we do have a couple of voices here notable for other connections to the DCAU. So let's talk about this week's voice cast.
Yeah, so we can just mention her since there's the least to say about her. Melissa Disney doing the ADR, the oofs and uhs of the fight scenes of Curare. Who does also voice Blade, one of Terry's classmates on Batman Beyond. So there was maybe about a year ago or so, James Tucker was talking about some sort of moments that he, as a storyboard artist or director, added that sort of changed the stories a little bit. Mm-hmm. One was a moment in Legacy where Professor Hamilton sort of looks very scared of Superman. That wasn't in the original script, and he drew it that way, and that obviously becomes a big linchpin of a Justice League storyline later.
Yeah.
For Curare, it's mentioned that in the first episode, there's a shot of her mask coming off, and I think in the script he said it was just, she just like knocks Batman down and puts the mask back on and we don't see anything. But he put that shot of like the back of her head where she's bald and has like, it looks like she's had some sort of damage done to her mm-hmm. face, and she looks disfigured, and you get that shot of Batman looking like horrified back at her.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned that that wasn't in the script, and that it actually kind of, for lack of a better term, ruined this idea that Glenn Murakami, who's a producer on this series, had to sort of make her an Elektra type character, assassin, femme fatale, potential even, you know, future romance, option for Terry later on in the series. And so I wonder if they had cast an actress for her with the idea that there will eventually be an idea or an episode where she talks and where she and Terry kind of have developed more of a relationship. But James, so yeah, this may or may not be all James Tucker's fault that we never get another Curare appearance, because once they couldn't do the Elektra angle with her, they ran out of ideas for her.
But, gotcha. That was fascinating. I thought, though, that you'd shared that before we went on the air, and
mm-hmm.
I think it makes as much sense as anything. Like, why else would you have an actual actress unless it was just, she's here recording these Blade voices anyway,
right.
So she's a female, let's just have her do some of this voice work for this character that we're not sure whether or not they're ever actually going to speak or not.
Yeah, I mean, you would have assumed it would have just been either, like in this episode, obviously Cree Summer as Max is in it. A lot of times, if there's not, you know, if it's not a lot of dialogue, you'll have a lot of actors pull double or even triple duty sometimes. So the fact that it was just going to be some grunts and groans, you would have expected maybe they would have gotten her, or Andrea Romano herself, or another one of the, you know, female writers or producers who come in to do, you know, background voices from time to time, maybe would have gotten the call instead. But yeah, I do think it's interesting that that they had cast like an actual, you know, regular voice artist in that role, and I wonder if there were some plans to bring her back at some point that just never came to fruition.
Definitely possible. All right, who else do we have here as far as voice cast is concerned?
So, briefly, as the Blofeld / Dr. Mindbender-esque assassin leader that we meet at the start, we have Victor Rivers, who DCAU fans would know best as the voice of Commander Hrotalik. I have to say his name like that. can't help it. But not
Hawkman, as we so endearingly call him.
He is definitely not Hawkman.
Not actual Hawkman from Starcrossed, of course.
That's right.
We covered back on episode 100. If you care to hear us discuss his performance on that episode,
absolutely. Yeah, it's just a minor role, but obviously worth pointing out.
Certainly,
he has a connection to a hugely important character to another series in the DCAU. But
for sure.
As soon as we heard it, we're like, well, we know that guy. And then he said like two more words, and I was like, that's Hrotalik.
Like, yeah, you called that pretty early.
He just has such a specific sort of accent, like a Spanish accent to his voice.
His cadence is very identifiable as well.
Yes, for sure.
Not my weapon of choice, but I won't hesitate to use it. You'll find I'm not as easy as your other targets. What? Society of Assassins trained us both well, Kurane. No one can match your skill with that sword. But I'll never let you get close enough to use it.
And Mutro Both. Batra, Bothra. I've been calling him Bothra this whole time.
I think it's Bothra.
Herein lies the problem of why we don't quite know how to pronounce the name, and that is that Tim Curry is doing the voice here. Tim Curry, of course, famous for things like Rocky Horror Picture Show, and as maybe more hardcore DCAU fans like us would know, he was the original voice of the Joker, and even recorded several of those early production order Batman the Animated Series Joker episodes. But
yeah, we just talked about him a little bit on our Batman Christmas with the Joker watch along, which
that's
you can
right.
hear in the archives at dcaureview.com, one of our latest bonus episodes that we recorded.
Absolutely, definitely check that out. So he was the original voice for the Joker. Of course, as fate and luck would have it, Mark Hamill ends up getting that job, and Tim Curry pops up actually quite a few times across the series in sort of different minor roles. But in this episode, and I think it works because they're these like globe-trotting assassins, so you don't necessarily want to be like, oh, he's specifically from this country.
Sure.
I think that's another thing we talked about with Kevin Altieri.
Correct.
In our off-balance review, is that, you know, these people have been around a long time and they've been all over the world, so they don't have necessarily an easy to pin down accent. But this accent that Bothra has in this episode, or Bothra has in this episode, is like, it's a little bit German, it's a little bit South African, it's a little bit, there's a little bit of, like, Europe, yeah, like, other, like, Europe in it. Like,
yeah.
it's kind of, it really takes us around the globe on it. And so when he says his name, I'm like, his name's what? but he has, I mean, I think he does a good job in that he's kind of playing this smug guy who's obviously basically holding the city for ransom because he doesn't want to die.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of gets his comeuppance in a strange way when Kiara does get to him and wipes his mind, doesn't kill him. But, the accent he goes with is so, like, go from line to line, from word to word. It sounds like, it can sound more like New Zealand, South African, and sometimes it sounds more, more European in some other parts. And it's a very, very unique performance from
that,
Mr. Curry.
That it is. Saying. That's putting it, I mean, and it's not bad, but it is at times, it felt a little bit distracting because he is one of the main voices that we hear besides, you know, we'll talk about Will Friedle and Cree Summer in just a second, but he is one of the main voices that we hear. So he's one of the heavier dialogue characters here. So you get a lot of it. And it does, as you mentioned, seem to morph from scene to scene. And it's, yeah, it can be a little distracting at times because your brain's like, what is this axe? And just when your brain feels like it is settled on one particular area, he throws in like some other nuanced version of another accent. And you're just like, all right, well, nope, it's definitely not that type of accent.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's not bad. I think he plays the character well. I just think maybe settling on one, like, or two accents instead of this conglomeration of smorgasbord of five or six accents could have made the performance a little bit easier to or less distracting, I'll say that.
Batman, come in. I can't stay hidden forever. Batman! Lesson number one, Curare. Always hold on to your weapon. No!
Yeah, I think that's a fair summation of that. And then, as you mentioned, we have our two main players. No Kevin Conroy in this episode, as mentioned. No Bruce Wayne at all. So it is Will Friedle as Terry McGinnis and Cree Summer as Max, who sort of carry the episode. And as we mentioned, that was kind of our favorite part of the plot. I like Cree Summer a lot in this episode because, again, I think she isn't just the person who's either giving Terry exposition like she has been in a few other episodes, nor is she just like, you know, the sassy sidekick who just quips it up. Like she goes through a lot in this episode. She very nearly dies.
Yeah.
And she is like clearly shaken by that. And I think you hear it in that voice performance when Batman returns to the hotel room, and then later on when they're talking in Max's apartment, and they're sort of just going over their plans and everything. Like, she goes through a lot in this episode, and then certainly near the end as she's sort of dodging debris and trying to figure out how to disarm this bomb. I think she does a really good job.
Can you disarm it?
If I had some help.
You're on your own, Max.
I don't know.
Max, we're running out of time here.
Flag it. Go home now.
No, I agree. I think she does have, I mean, Terry is pretty much Batman the entire time, with the exception of maybe that last scene. I guess, and the brief interactions that she has with him out of costume, or, you know, where they're sort of regrouping after she's had this experience with Curare. But, you know, it's a lot of it is her dialogue, and it's her, you know, like you said, it would have been very easy for them, and some of that goes to the writing aspect, but it would have been easy just to make her the quip machine for this episode, as we often see the sidekick or the, you know, the secondary character to the main hero reduced to at times. But she does a great job. I think she does a great job with the audio or, you know, with the lines that she has. There are some of those maybe in this episode, but you know, they were able to sort of allow this character to build a little bit, and having somebody that is able to deliver those lines and certainly various amounts of emotion. There's some, mm-hmm. the sort of like rebellious attitude as she's in the hotel mm-hmm. room, defiantly acting against what Terry had asked her or told her to do. There's some of the, like, the smugness as she sort of reveals to Terry, as we mentioned, that she knew the whole time that Bruce Wayne was her was his benefactor, or, mm-hmm. you know, the person that's sort of pulling the string, so to speak. And then, you know, her regrouping and this idea of her being a failure and messing up the whole thing by, you know, making Terry leave his post as guarding Butra to come save her, which allowed Curare the opportunity to wipe his mind, causing the bomb location to just be, you know, now it's indiscoverable at this point. To then her quickly recovering and using math as, you know, figuring out trigonometry to figure out where the bomb itself was. And then the final scene, as we mentioned, between the two of them, where he calls her, where Terry calls her his partner, and she, you know, kind of has this excitement and this realization that she's kind of in this now, and she mm-hmm. gets, Terry's kind of welcomed her, whereas before, and for a lot of the episode, he didn't want her involved, or seemed to not want her involved.
Yeah, for sure. I think that plays off pretty well, and certainly Wilfred L. and Cree Summer play off each other really well in this episode. And yeah, seeing Terry have to be the experienced one stepping into the more serious role and not having the sort of security blanket of Bruce Wayne in his ear is kind of a fun dynamic as well, because, again, especially I think as that final battle scene starts, and he's again really, really on the defensive for a lot of it, and it is kind of a cool moment for Terry, and in addition to him sort of strengthening his bond with Max, to also just sort of have to be like, all right, like, this is something we gotta figure this out for ourselves, because the old man's not gonna, you know, step in at the last second with the, you know, with the winning formula. We just gotta figure this out. So yeah, I think they both do a very good job. Like I said, the rest of the cast is largely not important to the episode,
right.
or has a confusing accent. that being said, I still settled on a pretty high 8 out of 10 for my voice acting.
Oh, well, what didn't you know? I gave it the same exact score, 8 out of 10. I think maybe with a little bit less distracting of an accent for Mr. Curry, maybe a little higher, because I don't think anybody did anything wrong in this episode. Pulling off of what we just said, but Cree Summer and Will Friedle do the majority of the heavy lifting here, and mm-hmm. they do a great job. They have chemistry together too, which works, and it's going to be very important based on certainly this relationship going forward, and what you know, her being sort of a part of this team. If they didn't have any chemistry, that would have been really painful.
Oh, yeah.
So the fact that they have some individually, they're good voice actors, and then together they still have chemistry, obviously very, very important. So yeah, great job by the voice acting, and certainly the voice casting, as we always give shout outs to Andrea Romano. You know, excellent job for this episode, for, you know, the limited amount of people that needed to be used. But certainly those that were called upon had to be people that could sort of carry the torch, so to speak. So yeah, great job overall.
Absolutely.
All right, Liam. Well, this will bring us to our final scores for this week's episode. Tallying everything up for me, I end up with a pretty impressive 29 out of 40. What about you?
Yeah, I ended up with the exact same score, that being 29 out of 40.
Yeah, you would think we don't, but you would think that we discuss our scores before this we go on the air, but we really don't.
That's right.
We just have a similar idea and appreciation for various different aspects here of the episode. So, all right. So this is an interesting one to discuss rewatchability, I guess, Liam. So obviously at the start of the episode, several times we've mentioned this is a follow-up to a Curare episode, which was pretty integral to that initial Batman Beyond season.
Mm-hmm.
You have certainly advancement between the Max and Terry relationship.
Right.
You have a verification or solidification of Max admitting that she knows that Bruce Wayne is the person that is the voice on the other end of Terry's radio comm most of the time. And so there's some movement there. We did mention, though, that this is the end of Curare, so there's nothing else to follow up on. The ending of Curare just sort of being handcuffed. We don't know. Does she go to prison? Does she go to whatever Arkham or whatever is now? Like, what happens to her? We don't get a follow up story here. So we're not quite sure here. So where does this fall for you as far as rewatchability is concerned?
I think this is one of my patented one thumb up rewatchers.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because of what we mentioned here, it does play directly on the events of another episode and follows up on them. But you know, it does sort of wrap itself up, and as you mentioned, we never see this character again. So, yeah, I think just the returning of a you know, a very cool villain combined with the Terry and Max stuff, I would give this one thumb up, but I don't think there's a ton in here, because to me, I didn't think before I watched this episode, I was never thinking like, oh, Terry's never like come out and said exactly that he's working with Bruce Wayne. Like, I kind of figure like publicly he works with Bruce Wayne, that's his job, that all of his friends and his girlfriend, who deserves better, knows. that's what he tells them he's doing, and then all of a sudden when you find out he's the new Batman, well, it's like, well, who's the old Batman? Oh, probably that old guy he's always hanging around with.
Right.
Like, so I didn't think it was like, oh my gosh, it's this big revelation. And even in the dialogue, as we pointed out, like, Max is like, yeah, I know, like, who else was it?
Right.
So I wouldn't say it's like this big grand revelation, but it is, obviously there are episodes later on where Max and Bruce interact that maybe play off of or build on, you know, off of this episode a little bit. So yeah, like I said, I think I'd give it one thumb up for rewatchability.
Yeah, I agree. I think the final sequence and certainly the battle, there's enough entertainment and action in this episode to recommend it. You know, if you do care, that first episode with Curare ends on that cliffhanger of her flying away and the sword falling through. So it's almost to me, you have to, because it's the resolution to that character, even if that resolution isn't completely satisfying.
That's right. It's like episode nine. Doesn't matter if it's good. It's the end.
It's the end. You have to see it. Right. That's exactly. So yeah, I guess I would say this is a must watch for that reason alone. If it was a standalone episode without a reoccurring villain, then I think that maybe I would be singing a different tune here. Although we always talk about it, you know, we already stated the characters are different than when the episode started. Terry starts out and is still very reluctant to bring Max in and have her be a part of, you know, the whole Bat family, I guess.
Yeah.
And by the end of the episode, he's calling our partners. So there is a shift in that.
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly a shift in, you know, I guess the beyond the Max and Terry dynamic, Max realizing or sort of going through a similar experience that the general hero of your story goes through, which is this, you know, defeat in the middle of it and excitement at the beginning and cockiness and confidence, and then sort of having the confidence ripped away from them when they feel like they've bungled it, but then recovering and then saving the day in the end. So
yeah.
She, you know, you get more depth to the Max character, who, you know, maybe you didn't get quite fleshed out in the prior episodes, where she was more the focal point. So yeah, I guess for those reasons, I give it a must watch. So there we have it. All right, Liam, well, that will wrap us up for this week's episode. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Don't forget, you can check us out in our entire archives, including that first Curare episode, at dcaureview.com or on your favorite podcast app. We are now hosting at anchor.fm, so you can check us out there if you will. You can also always find us still at dcaureview.com. We break things down on our own website by villain, series, the highest highs of our rankings, the best of the best episodes. We put that under our top picks section, so you can check that out. You can also certainly, again, break things down by villain or series, or have a whole bunch of different features there. You can also check out our store, our podcast merch store there. If you want to support the podcast, we don't run ads on our podcast at this time. because we don't like ads. We don't like podcasts with ads. So if you want to support us, if you like us, then and you want to show us a little bit of love, check out the store, get yourself a shirt, a hat, a hoodie, a mug even, and let us know that you like us. Tag us once you get your merch too. Let us know that you're supporting us. You can also follow us on social media at DCAU Review, both on Instagram and Twitter. And speaking of Twitter, Liam, you run our Twitter page. That's where we talk about the episodes during the week, all other things DCAU, even some standard DC continuity. And of course, where we like to preview our upcoming episodes, which we will do right here, right now. We've probably already talked about it this week on Twitter, but what's coming up next week on next week's episode of the DCAU Review?
That's right. So it'll be another episode of Batman Beyond, as we will be staying with that all February long, and it will be the next episode in production order. That episode being called The Last Resort.
Okay.
Which is an interesting episode involving some of Terry's friends getting thrown in like a weird reform school, like boarding school type place that has some questionable educational methods. We'll just leave it there, and definitely check our Twitter and Instagrams. You can find a little clip from that episode and probably a preview of our review of it as well. As well as some other fun stuff, so be sure to check us out at DCAU Review, both on Twitter and Instagram.
Awesome. Well, until next week, I am Cal.
And I'm Liam.
And we will talk to you on the next episode of the DCAU Review.
Bye-bye.